gotta call.
Do you have a van with a certain amount of capacity?
Well, I'm threatening I can film in the back of my Pilot and lay the seats down and slide a little bit. Put them in the front seat and lay the seats back.
Can make El
Camino. Oh, there you go. He always loved the open air.
And the Pilot's terrible. And then there's Jenna. She got a tan today. She looks so healthy and glowing. And then Anthony has a tan.
All right, it is time to begin. It is time to get started tonight. We're going to finish chapters 15 through 20 in 2 Samuel, and we're going to cover 6 chapters in one night, so it'll be kind of quick. We're not going to be spending a whole lot of time digging into any particular passage or any particular event, but if we get sidetracked and start talking about it, that's all right. Travis can pick up chapter 21 on Sunday, or Sean, whoever's teaching him. Before we do that, though, we're going to ask Anthony, if you will, to lead us in prayer.
Our Father in heaven, we come before you now. Father, we're thankful for this time we can study and open up your word. And as we come towards the end of the study of this class, we pray that we carry these things with us, that we remember the stories, the lessons, that we think of things like David and how, think of his humanity, how he made mistakes, he had tendencies, and yet he always turned to you. And Father, we pray that you be with all the teachers at this time. Help them to present well the things they prepare, and only present things that are from your word. And this is our prayer in Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. All right, 2 Samuel, chapters 15 through 20, and we talked on Sunday about how David's house went flat, taking that from the song from BBS of the wise man built his house on the rock, and foolish man built his house on the sand, and David became a fool as he approached that midlife crisis time period in life, reaching around 48 to 50, somewhere around 50. We just rounded off to say he was 50 years old when that happened, and with Bathsheba and Uriah. And so as a result of his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah and the murder of Uriah, he was pronounced a judgment was pronounced upon him by God in 2 Samuel 12 verses 11 through 15. We talked about how that the sword would never depart from his house. He would have that from within his own house there would be people that would rise up, and the child that was born from the adultery would die as well. And so there were 4 of those that we talked about on Sunday morning. And so we talked a little bit about, in chapter 13, how his son Amnon, who was the crown prince, he was the oldest son, he was the next in line, raped his half-sister Tamar, David's daughter. And David did what?
Nothing.
All right, then Absalom, was the full brother of Tamar, hid her away in his house, protected her and cared for her in his house. But he also hid in his heart hatred toward his brother Amnon that he sat on for 2 years before he was able to enact revenge or bring about the revenge that he wanted to bring. And so he had him murdered there, invited him to a party at a sheep shearing time. That's basically at harvest time. You're collecting, you're going to make your money from all the work that you did over the year, preparing for that time period. And so he's going to have a celebration, and he invites his father David. David says no, and he ends up bringing Amnon in, and was able then to kill Amnon. So he kills Amnon, or has him killed, murdered by his servants. That's a whole different discussion about how the servants just did what they were told and didn't say, can't do that, I'm going to commit murder for you. But anyway, that's a different discussion. So if we didn't really touch on this, but during this event, while all this was unfolding, all the other sons of David who had come, and we don't know how many there are by this time, they all came jumped on their donkeys and went fleeing back to Jerusalem. But the news raced ahead of them, and what did David hear? You better remember what David heard first. That all his sons were killed. Who was there to tell him, no, David, don't worry, the king, don't worry, it's just Amnon.
Joab.
Not Joab, but it starts with a J. The same
Jonadab,
the same slimy or crafty guy who told Amnon how to go about them being able to rape her sister, being able to get access to her. Anyway, so fortunately, that's the last time we ever hear from him. You would hope that somewhere along the way, he received the just dues for being such a slimy person, but we hear nothing about it. We don't know. We know eventually, unless he repented, he got it, what he deserved in the end. But so far, as a result of David's adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah, we have two dead sons, the baby, and now Amnon, one violated daughter. And what does David do now?
Nothing.
Still doing nothing. So Absalom, though, wisely runs to Grandpa's house in Geshur, and he's there for 3 years. So we had 2 years of plotting, 3 years now in exile, away from home. And then in a mistaken effort to fix things, who arranges to make sure that Absalom is brought back to Jerusalem?
Joab.
Okay, you mentioned Joab. So Joab gets him brought back, and we went over all those things on Sunday. But even there, for two more years, there is no reconciliation with David. David says he can come back to Jerusalem, but I will not see him. And then something happens, and Absalom forces Joab to come see him and get him back into the presence of the king. And so there's a kiss. But has anything changed by this time? Well, one thing has changed. And that is that in this sense, there is no ability, no opportunity, nothing for any reconciliation between David and his son Absalom. Any chance of healing that rift, of fixing that wound, is dead and gone, just like Amnon, just like the baby, and desolate, just like Tamar was described. And so now in chapter 15, we begin to see how Absalom is beginning to get ready to act against his father. So he's so deep in the rebellion that nothing is going to change. And we're going to read in chapters 15 through 20 the rebel alliances. As a bar Star Wars reference there, the rebel alliances that are going to take place. Because not only is Absalom going to lead a rebellion, even after his death, not long after, there's a second rebellion, and that's chapter 20. That's short-lived rebellion, but still another effort to overthrow and undermine King David. All right, so we're going to begin with these rebel alliances and just kind of look through these. First thing that I want to look at is in chapter 15, and this is what I'm going to call the Thief of Hearts. Thief of Hearts, chapter 15, verses 1 through 13. And we're simply not going to have time to read all of this. So look at verse 6. In this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. So that's where I got the thief of hearts idea here. So somebody tell me what unfolds here in this section in verses 1 through 13 in chapter 15. A brief summary.
Absalom just gives preliminary judgments before they can actually go before the king and tells them how right they are and how much he would do them justice if only he were the judge in Israel.
Alright, so he was buttering everybody up. They would come to Jerusalem, they would have cases that might be brought to the king, and he would intercept them and butter them up, lavish them with love and affection, and that's how he was able to steal their hearts. Back in chapter 13. We didn't really look at chapter 14. We didn't look at this much. Or we actually didn't even read this section. But verses 25 through 27 describes Absalom in what way? Verse 25 says, now in all Israel was no man as ugly as Absalom. Is that what it says?
No.
Handsome. All right, he was the most handsome guy in town. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. And then it talks about how he cut his hair. There's a little foreshadowing there about his hair. Now, we read that, basically the 200 shekels weight, that's about 3 to 5 pounds. It varies from whoever you talk to. 3 to 5 pounds. Now, me and Mitch, we cut our hair. We let it grow all year, and it's still not going to be 3 to 5 pounds. I don't care how much oil we put in it. But you got to remember, it was long, curly, thick. It would have oil. It would be oiled. And some commentator said that he even would sprinkle gold in it to make it look, to sparkle, make it look better. So he would cut it, and he would boast in his ability to have this beautiful haircut. Now, Karen and I were talking about this, and you read through this in this description about his appearance. Remember how David was first described back in 1 Samuel chapter, what is it, chapter 15, and 13, verse 14 and 15, verse 28. 13, 14 says, God has sought out a man after what?
His own heart.
His own heart, and has made him king. So we don't know who that is yet, but then we find out later this David. In chapter 15, verse 28, he says that God has torn this kingdom away from you and given him to your neighbor, who is more handsome than you. Verse 28 of chapter 15 has a little bit different description. Chapter 13, verse 14. Chapter 15, verse 28 says he is better than you. So both passages that are talking about David describe what he is on the inside, his character. And remember, when Samuel went there, what was the first thing Samuel was looking at?
The outside.
The external appearance, the outside. Exactly. And so God says, don't look at the outside, look at what's on the inside. So Absalom is described basically entirely on what he looks like on the outside. And Karen and I were talking about this earlier, and I wanted her to say what she told me about the raising and how this would have impacted Absalom and how all these sons thought of themselves.
Okay. What I said was that you have one dad, many wives, many children, and then the wives raise the children, and David, as the king, mostly has no part in their upbringing. So they are, each mother loves her eldest son and grooms him with hopes of him being the king, and says things to him like, you're so handsome, you're so beautiful, you deserve to be king because you're better than everybody else. And what they raise is a bunch of spoiled rotten bread. Why David spent his life taking care of sheep alone in a field, so much so that his daddy didn't even remember he had him. And he had to work and be a man when he was just a boy. And that's the difference between their characters.
Yeah, and we were talking about how when you look at what's going on in American culture today, you're having that kind of home life becoming far more pervasive throughout culture, of fatherless homes. And if you do any real studies of culture and society, there are three guarantees of juvenile delinquency: is no father in the house, poverty, and mothers who quit school and have babies before they're out of high school, and it just escalates. I was talking to Todd Embry about this the other day, and he said that his wife, Angie, teaches school over in Morgantown. And she's like, I think it's second or third grade level. And of her 23 children, 3 of them are in two-parent homes. And several of them, probably 3 or 4 of them, are being raised by grandparents. And so that just escalates into an unmanageable life. And that's why Absalom and Amnon, they're spoiled brats, they're used to getting their way, they're not being disciplined by a father who is there to show them how to be a man. The only example they got, Absalom and Amnon got from their dad, was you take what you want, and then if there's an inconvenience, you kill it. So it just really creates a massive problem. So Absalom is sitting there, he's meeting people at the gate, he's this spoiled brat, he thinks, all right, I've killed my brother, I'm going to be next in line, so I'm going to make sure that even if I'm not dad's favorite anymore, I'm going to get the throne, and I'm going to take it by force. I'm going to kill my own dad. Effectively is what he's going to do. Now, how long did that process of stealing the hearts take? Didn't happen overnight. In fact, some of your versions may have an unusually large number. Chapter 15, verse 7.
40 years.
40 years. All right. That's most people agree that that's a scribal error. That's 40 or 4, not 40. 4 years. But even if you have 4, think about this. We're talking about David was rounded off to 50. He was 50 when all this took place, or let's say 48 with Absalom, all right, with Bathsheba and Uriah. You have 2 years before you had the birth. You have 2 years after, you know, Absalom's out. I'm trying to do the math here. Try to get us a picture of this. So, commits adultery with Uriah or with Bathsheba, and then kills Uriah. Baby dies, probably at, 6 months to a year old. Then Bathsheba has another son, Solomon. So that's a couple of years or so. Then you have 2 years. Then you have the rape of Tamar. And then you have 2 years before you have Amnon killed. Then you have 3 years of exile, so that's 5 years. So say he's 48, so now you're at 55. David's 55, trying to give you an idea how old David was. Then you've got 2 more years of living in Jerusalem before he's even allowed to see his father. And then after he's reconciled with his father, another 4 years. So you're talking about a dozen or more years. So how old is David now when this rebellion hits?
Around 60.
Mike.
And just a thought on the 40. I mean, I know they started young back then, perhaps. Yeah, at the end of his 40 years. And Absalom was 40.
Okay, you're saying some commentators may say Absalom was 40? Well,
David would have been quite young when he was born, but
Absalom was born when David was in Hebron, and so he would, at that time David would be nearly 30, or actually in Ziklag. So David would have been nearly 30 by then. So this is only 30 years later. So at this point, Absalom's in his 30s. Now you also have generational issues. What happens? What do the 30-year-olds think about a 60-year-old guy?
What do they know?
Yeah, they're old. They're decrepit. They don't know all this newfangled technology stuff like computers and interweb and things like that.
I resemble that remark.
So you've got a young, handsome guy. David now is in his probably hitting 60, early 60s, and he's old and gray. Maybe his hair is falling out like some of us, There's a whole generation that's like, who's David? We weren't around when he did all this stuff. He doesn't mean anything to us. We need a young, hip, happening king. And Absalom is the man for the job. So he's going to be over 60 or in his 60s by this time. So it's a real change taking place here. All right, any thoughts or comments about Absalom and how he got ready to take over?
So Solomon would have been like elementary school age.
Yes, at this point, Solomon's a child. He's probably 24, 20, in his early 20s when David dies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so he's still, so he's at this point.
I was thinking like 10 or something.
Well, you add the 11 years, so about 10 or 11. Yeah. Because then he died, he's in his 20s when his dad dies.
And 10-year-old's old enough to pay attention.
Yeah, yes.
But they know things.
They're well aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. All right, so the next section is refugees from rebellion. The refugees are running. Obviously, today in our culture, or in our world, there are a lot of refugees fleeing from various conflicts. And when we were in Florida back a few weeks, 2 months ago, we met a guy and his wife that had, that Brian Whiteside was roommates with him, that had to flee from Ukraine. Refugees from Ukraine. So the world's full of folks having to flee warfare and rebellion. So beginning then in verse 12 of chapter 15, you have, or verse 14 really, you have David starting to head down to the uh, starting to leave the city. Verse 13, a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. So, you know, where's David been? What's he doing this whole time his son is sucking up to all these people that are coming into town? Does he not know what's going on? Maybe he just thinks that, well, I'm David. The people would never do this to me. You know, they remember what I did for them. They remember how I fought for them and saved them from the Philistines and so forth.
I know God's anointed.
Yeah. So, complacency, privilege. You know, I think there's something about leadership that if you're in leadership positions for a long time, it begins to kind of make you. I think even the best of men can subtly become so accustomed to it they just don't think that there's any other way it could be. And they have a hard time stepping down when it's time. You know, that's one thing I admire about my dad. He was in his early 80s and said, I'm stepping down. Just let the young guys take over. He's an elder of the church. Said it's time to let new or younger people take over. You know, of course, to him, younger people were people in their 60s, not 30s, early 40s, you know, our 40-year-old. But anyway. So youth is a relative term in that respect. Yes?
Kind of seems like, too, given the trouble David had with Bathsheba, and I think the Bible states that at that time kings were out to war, or off to war. Where is he? You know, he's in the palace.
He's in the palace. He's restless.
Yeah, so I think there's some tendency maybe to, and, you know, of course, we don't know, but maybe to think, I put my time in, I fought hard. You know, I mean, he did. He fought battle after battle after battle and, you know, got to the place that he was told he should be, which is king. Mm-hmm. And maybe he just decided to live it up for a little bit. But, you know, with that comes bad things that happen too, just like you and Karen talking about. If you still don't put that time into your children, even if they're weak, you know, little bitties or they're, you know, teenagers or whatever, you're going to lose them.
Yeah. Good point. So, I think there's something there worth, there was something going on that led to all this, that precipitated, yeah. Okay?
He kind of checked out.
That's a good way to put it. He checked out and what did he pay for? All right, so the refugees, as he's talking about fleeing Jerusalem, and we won't read all this passage because, again, we just don't have time to it, but he has a number of men that come out to him that want to join with him, some from good motives, some from bad motives. A guy named Ittai comes out, and David says, you just moved here. You're an exile from your company to the country. You just moved here. I go home, and I love what he said in verse 21. As the Lord lives, and as my Lord the King lives, surely wherever my Lord the King may be, whether for death or for life, there also your servant will be. So this guy was going to stick with David come what may. That was a tremendous attitude. So he went with him.
It's a Ruth-like statement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, commitment. He's committed to God, and he's committed to God's king. All right, Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, come with the ark. David, they stand there while the people are leaving the city. And I started to get a photograph, or not a photograph, but a drawing, an artistic drawing of what Jerusalem would look like at that time. Because the walls, or the city, the walls were high, and then you had these walls of the cliffs that it sat on, dropped really pretty much straight down. There have been so many attacks on Jerusalem that there really has been filled in a lot, but even now you can still see there's a good drop off down to the creek, down to the brook, the Kidron Valley, and then up to Mount of Olives. But during the time of David, that would have been a much steeper drop, and then a higher climb up to the mountain, and then a big steep drop down to the Jerusalem, down to the Jordan. So David has to go down to the Kidron Valley. The priests are up there, and all the people are coming out with him. David sends the priest back with the ark, says, y'all stay there. In fact, he says, you got boys that can act as spies, and recruits them as spies. So he sends them back. And then also you have the other fellows come out. Ziba comes out. What is Ziba? Does anybody remember Ziba? Who he was?
Mephibosheth.
He was a servant of Mephibosheth. And Ziba is a guy that comes out and he basically takes his master's stuff. and gives it to David and acts like it was all his doing, when I think we'll see later that Mephibosheth was, he was a David guy all through and through. But the character, I want to show you this. This gives you an idea of the decline, how far down they have to go. So you give a steep drop down in the Kidron Valley, then they climb up to the Mount of Olives. It talks about climbing up to the Mount of Olives in the book. Then you drop down to that shoulder, then it just keeps on going down. And then there's another hilltop that you got to go up and then back down. You go from basically 2,500 feet above sea level down to 800 feet below sea level. So you got a 3,000 something foot climb down with babies and women and children. Who does David have to take with him?
All his other family.
What happens if he leaves any of his boys there?
Execution.
Actually, they're dead. He has to, at least now he has to be concerned about his kids to make sure that they stay alive. So you have that one. And then this one is another one that I found that gives you an idea of how far. So it's a 23-mile walk, most of it downhill. So almost 3,000 feet drop from Jerusalem itself down to the Jericho down to Jordan Valley. Now, walk around the hills of here in western Kentucky. Do we have any 3,000 feet drops?
No.
Where do you have to go to get those?
It felt like it on campus, but it's not really there.
yeah, especially in the winter or in the heat of the summer, one of the extremes. Yeah, you have to go to Black Mountain over in Harlan County, on the eastern side of the state, because there you have a 4,000-foot mountain top. You go down in the steep mountains. All right. So anyway, just give you an idea of the climb down that they had to do. So he does that, and then there's a guy named Shimei that comes out. Shimei, every time I read about Shimei, every time I think about Shimei, I can't help but remember this incident from baseball. What's he doing?
He's getting dirt on the umpire. I had explained it to a student one day what that meant. But the insult of kicking the dirt on the umpire.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to punch him.
I kept thinking Pete Rose did it, but Pete Rose gave the umpire a shove. But anyway, in the bit, this was a video. I just took a screenshot of the video. But the video was kind of blurry, so and shaky. So anyway, I think of that. So what does Shimei do? He's a Benjaminite of the relations distantly to Saul. And so he goes along and he says, "You're a man of blood, good riddance, you dirty dog."
Is it the
dirt clods and rocks.
Isn't he the one that David leaves a message for Solomon to have him executed when he dies?
To watch him.
Yeah.
To watch him, because Sheba, as we'll see in chapter 20, is also from the tribe of Benjamin. So, no indication that he was involved in that, but there's this tribe of Benjamin, anybody that's going to be so opposed to David and then visibly and vocally opposed to David has to be watched, because it's not going to be a good guy. All right, so he sends, they're going down the distance, they're having to go down. You got Get Ittai, Zadok, and Abiathar, Ahithophel, and Hushai. All right, two guys are mentioned here, and I didn't talk about Ahithophel and Hushai. You remember who those guys were? Anybody? Those are good names for children, if anybody here wants to have more children.
I can't even watch what my parents did. So
Ahithophel is the one that advised Absalom to go up onto the rooftops and take his father's concubines. All the people could see.
Yeah. Ahithophel was a counselor of David who joined David's son. So, I mean, he was a traitor. And he's also the one that advised Absalom to do exactly what you said, go up and have sex with David's concubines in public, basically. I mean, not totally in public, but everybody knew what was going on when they went into the tent.
But I thought everybody left the city.
Not everybody. There are plenty of people that would have stayed there. Just anybody that's connected to David.
Okay. Because you know how they use for all the people, all of Judah, the websites.
Not only, it would have been a lot of them, and Absalom brought a lot of people in with them, too. Oh, when he came in, he would have a lot of his followers with them, and you can imagine the pillaging and all the other things. I'm sure that those concubines weren't the only ones being violated. I mean, it brings out, these kind of things bring out the worst in men. And so it would, you know, it was just an awful, awful event. So Ahithophel is a former advisor of David, who became an advisor of Absalom. Hushai is an advisor of David, who's going to go with David. He's older, old guy, probably older than David, so he's older than me, which is older than dirt. And so David says, you stay here and do what?
Advice from that Ahithophel.
Exactly.
Tell him the opposite. Exactly
right. So what he does is he uses him to stall the rebellion. He says, whatever Ahithophel says, you find a way to undermine him and defeat his counsel. Because if Ahithophel gets his way, it's all lost. So you've got to stop him. Alright, so he's stalling the rebellion. That's chapter 16, verse 15 through chapter 17, verse 23. We've already talked about the repulse of sin that Absalom committed publicly. And David sends Hushai there to talk him in and find ways to counter Ahithophel and make sure that the rebellion fails. To stall it out. Give them time to escape and prepare and plan and prepare for a response. All right. Thoughts, questions to this point? We only got about 10 minutes left. I want to cover the rest of it if we can. Okay. Everybody quiet tonight? Long day? Okay. All right. So the next point is divide and conquer. What plan does David put in place to defeat a superior army number-wise? Line up like they did in Civil War and stand across from each other and shoot each other with arrows? Or what? There's a phrase there, divide, that should give you a hint from the text.
He sent one third of his army with Joab, so that they divided his people to get.
Yeah, you just get the answer there. How many? The
three of them.
Three parts under different leaders to basically do kind of like the Continental Army did during the Revolutionary War. You had a lot of, instead of lining up against people, you had ambushes and you had guerrilla warfare, as they call it. That's how the Comanches and Geronimo, the Navajo Indians, were able to stay successful against the U.S. Army. They couldn't fight them head-on in a battle, so they had to use guerrilla warfare, as they call it, hiding and attacking from the side. And so David divides up his army in that way and sends them out to fight and to go out and find a way to defeat them. All right? So David does that. He sends them out. He's going to go out with them. So what do they tell this 62-year-old or 60-year-old man?
You stay back.
You stay home. Yeah.
Have a seat, Grandpa.
Yeah. You got bad knees, David. You can't see. You got like five pair of glasses on, just trying to see from the string to put the arrow on. So he listens to them. Now they're not so rude as to say, David, you're old. Give it up, man. What do they say?
You're special.
You're worth 10,000.
Yeah.
And that was true. And that was a nice way to put it. And basically, you wouldn't be able to escape either. But they see you out there, and everybody's going after you. And you go down, it's done.
It's an interesting number because that was the song they sang about David early in his life, about killing the 10,000.
Yeah, interesting combination of numbers there. Okay. All right, so they send him out. Now, he makes it kind of an interesting request. What does he tell the soldiers and the generals as they leave?
Be gentle with Absalom.
Yeah. With the young man. We had a situation one time in, how shall I put this? A man who was causing difficulty in the congregation. And somebody said, well, the boy, and I said, stop. He's 40 years old. And I don't want to hear about the boy. He's a man. Treat him with the dignity and respect that he deserves as a man and with the responsibility that he deserves as a man. Right? So, how does Absalom, what happens to Absalom though?
Is that beautiful hair on the tree?
Yeah, you got everybody pictures that probably that thick wad of hair got caught up in the branches. And so he's hanging there, and the donkey goes out from underneath him, and his hair is stuck. You know, I think everybody pictures it like his head's caught like this, so he could pull himself up out of that. It's that hair. You ever got your hair tangled up in something? Ladies that have hair?
My wife did in a weed eater once.
Ooh. Yeah, think of, think of a weed eater and vines. Oh, wow. Yeah, that would not be good. So, so the guy that finds him does what? Does he kill him?
Yes.
No, the guy that finds him
didn't kill him. He runs to tell Joab.
He runs to Joab, and Joab says, I'll give you $100 to go kill him. And the guy says, give me $1,000,000, I ain't going to kill him. You remember what David said. Joab goes and kills him, stabs him 3 times. Kind of an interesting... somewhat similar sort of anti-type of Christ. He's hung on a tree. His side is pierced by a former friend and dies there. It's not a type of, but an anti-type of Christ. Kind of a contrasting similarity versus a comparison or in that sense. I think it's interesting how that unfolds. Alright, and then because in chapter 18, verses 19 through chapter 19, verse 8, you have David's grief, a father's grief. Talk about a father's grief. I mean, this breaks David's heart because what does David really know?
Oh, his fault.
It's my fault. I caused this.
I've done something way back then.
Yeah, if I had not gone on that rooftop, or if I had gone on that rooftop and looked down this, oop, not looking at that, ain't going to do it. How things would have been different.
Been more hands-on with his sons.
And just more involved. Had fewer wives. Because I thought about trying to count, but there's no way to know how many wives and children he actually had by this point. He had 10 concubines. 10 of them that we know of.
10 to spare.
Yeah.
You stay back and keep house, the passage said.
And it's interesting that he's all of his time is taken away. Bible says, fathers, raise your children for admonition of the Lord. And that's an Old Testament and a New Testament idea that fathers will do that. And when you've got all these women in your life, and I'm not trying to sound like a sexist, but when you got all these women in your life like this, you're not paying attention to your children. Your mind's on something else.
Yeah, well, that's not making sense. That's pointing out that the man was a dog in some way, in respect.
And his son Solomon is the same way.
Yeah, it showed when you're given something like that that there's it's an unusual man that can say, you know what, I'm going to stick with one wife. I mean, at least Abraham, one wife, one incident with another woman, as opposed to having several concubines and a bunch of children. You know, so it goes back to the beginning, to the instruction in the garden. Please find the money, please his wife. All right? So father's grief. So he had just grief-stricken. My son Absalom. And as I think about that, I think of that in terms of, and this is what I said earlier, that previously that I was going to bring out this kind of similarity between David and God. Again, that anti-type and type. The anti-type is because it's not exactly like Solomon, like Jesus dying on the cross, but it has some similarities, and the grief of the Father. You know, there are some people who say, and maybe you heard this, and maybe you believe this, and say that when, you know, Jesus was on the cross, God can't look at sin, passage taken out of context, and said that, well, God had to, you know, why have you forsaken me? God turned his back on Christ on the cross. I think that's just nonsense. I think God was watching it unfold, pouring his wrath out on his own son, and furious at mankind for having to do it. And the same kind of grief.
Well, Jesus would have said, wouldn't have spoke to God if he was not listening. Right?
Exactly. It just, that's a side point. But anyway, I think of the grief. I think this is an illustration of David's heart going out to his son. Even who was a sinner. God's heart goes out to his son who was not a sinner and to all those sons who become his sons through Christ. This is the glory and the majesty of the God that we serve, is demonstrated here in a little bit of a way, like David. I just think it's very important to see that. All right, we've got two more points in 4 minutes. All right, return of the king. Interesting story unfolds. The king is brought back. Who starts the process of saying, okay, we need to get David back to Jerusalem as king? Joab tells him, quit your whining, you're going to lose your entire kingdom. But the 10 tribes, the ones who had rebelled and gone with Absalom, are saying, okay, David was the guy that saved us from the Philistines after all and established the kingdom and established all these alliances and made us safe. Hey, let's bring him back and make him king again. Who comes in second and takes over? His own tribe, Judah. And when his own tribe, Judah, brings him in and brings him back to Jerusalem, who is, then there's conflict. This is, again, prelude to things that are going to unfold later. There's conflict between the 10 tribes and Judah over who should have brought him in. And the 10 tribes have made a point. Hey, we have 10 shares in the king. Simeon and Judah, because Simeon's actually within the territory of Judah, so those two are his family, but we're a part of them too. But it doesn't work for very long. So the king comes back, 10 tribes are still feel slighted, and so in chapter 20, you have one more rebellion. Fickle hearts, we call it, because what happens with those 10 tribes that said we should have brought him back? Let's bring him back.
He wasn't worth bringing back.
They went back the other way when they had an opportunity. A man named Sheba, leads rebellion, so the 10 tribes go off with him. And David puts Amasa, he's trying to reconcile the 10 tribes. He puts Amasa, who's a relative of sorts, lets him be the general. Who stabs him? This one looks like he did Abner. Joab stabs him, murders him, and becomes king again. So anyway, so Sheba runs to a city, and he's staying in the city, and the army comes up around him. And this story here is very interesting because it's the exact opposite of what happened with Jephthah in the contract of the siege of Thebes back in Judges chapter 9. Not Jephthah, it was one of the other kings, forget his name now. What happened to that king? Remember, he was up underneath the tower and they're trying to take the tower, and a woman throws what?
Millstone.
Throws a millstone out over the edge of the tower, and it hits him in the head. And he says, "Tells the servant, stab me so that I can't say the woman killed me." You talking about sexist? That's sexist right there. So, in contrast to this, he gets hit in the head and killed. Joab's outside. He calls to the people. Said, "Listen, we don't want to kill anybody here. We just want Sheba." And so, what does a wise woman do? She tossed to the rest of the men, and they cut Sheba's head off and tossed it over the cliff, over the edge of the tower, and they collect and go home, and the rebellion is over. And then the end of the chapter, verses 23 through 26, tells us some of the people that are put in place and the authority. So you're talking now, David's, this is 6-7 years or thereabout until David's dead. But what is happening? This is all the result of David's refusal to resist the temptation with Bathsheba and then to kill Uriah. Now, all of these people are not puppets. They're all acting basically on their own initiative. But this is the result. This is what the cost of sin we talked about on Sunday. When you decide to sin, it's going to have an effect. You throw a rock in a pond, what's it going to do? It's going to cause ripples. It's going to cause ripples up and down, actually, within as well, within the pot. Stir up the sediment at the bottom. So
it might float.
Not the rock will float.
Also, when people perceive a weakness, they're going to look for an opportunity to take advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there are always wicked people, exactly.
That's once good. Everybody knew about this chink in David's armor, mm-hmm. It's only natural. Take him down.
Yeah. Thoughts, comments?
I've got a question about chapter 18, verse 8. That says, the battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. What does that mean?
Well, there was a forest there, and I think basically means that